discerninghearts.com, and Spirit Catholic Radio, in cooperation with the Pope Paul VI Institute, presents Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. Dr. Hilgers, after being deeply touched by the teachings of Pope Paul VI's encyclical Humanae Vitae, founded the Pope Paul VI Institute for the Study of Human Reproduction in Omaha, Nebraska. Dr. Hilgers, along with his co-workers, developed the Creighton Model Fertility Care System. He would go on to discover Napro technology. In 1994, Pope John Paul II appointed him to full membership in the Pontifical Academy for Life. And with his wife Susan, Dr. Hilgers serves on the Pontifical Council for the Family. Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. In the last several segments, we have talked about women being healed, how we can better have control of our health by cooperating with our bodies and in allowing God to show us the way. Through that work, you have opened up a lot of vistas for us, a lot of information. And today on this particular segment, we're going to talk about surgical treatments. How would you like to open that discussion? Because it's such a broad area.
Well, probably in a couple different ways. When we talk about surgical treatments, particularly when it deals with the reproductive system in women, we're talking about the prevention of scar tissue while at the same time reconstructing the uterus, tubes, and ovaries when it's badly damaged. This idea that you can do a surgical procedure that may be extremely extensive and do it in such a way that there is no scar tissue or only minimal scar tissue most of the time is very foreign to the current surgical practice in either gynecology or reproductive endocrinology. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is, in terms of my own background in this, when I joined the faculty at St. Louis University School of Medicine, I had just finished my residency in obstetrics and gynecology, and I was very interested in the endocrinology, which is the hormones of the menstrual cycle, and how it fit together with all of these different conditions we've been talking about. As I was practicing at St. Louis University and getting involved in various things, the chairman of my department came to me one day and he said, "How would you like to go and become a reproductive endocrinologist?" Now, a reproductive endocrinologist is a 2-year additional fellowship, which you have to take, and they are experts in the field of the hormones of the reproductive system, basically. This is what I was interested in. And so I had to think for a moment about that. And I was young. It would have been a great time for me to do this. But I told him that I did not like the way reproductive endocrinology was going at that time, what direction it was heading, because it was heading straight ahead towards in vitro fertilization, artificial insemination, and all of the things that I didn't believe at all in, and not only morally, but medically. And so I told him that I really didn't want to do that. I said I would do much better spending my time in research at the university and attending postgraduate courses and learning in a little bit of a different way. So I attended probably 10 or 15 really in-depth, high-level postgraduate courses where I began to pull together many of the ideas and thoughts that could come together in not only surgical treatment but also the various hormone therapies that we might use in women who have fertility problems, infertility, miscarriage, or whatever. I learned in a kind of an alternative tract. So because of that, of course, today's world, if you're not a reproductive endocrinologist, people look down on that. But that's really okay with me because I've been at this long enough. I'm at such an age that I'm not too worried about it. I do worry, however, about the younger generation coming along, and I know we're going to talk about that at a later time. So we'll leave that for then. But I found that you could do these surgical procedures and not get adhesions if you did certain types of things. And so starting in about 1985, really up until the present time, we began a process of implementing new types of strategies or different types of strategies in this whole process of adhesion-free surgery, which we now call surgical Napro technology. We have gotten to the point where, just to give you a little bit of an idea, there is a surgical adhesion scoring system that the American Fertility Society published several years ago for people who do research. A high score, really high score, is in the 30 to 35 range. The score of the patients I was operating on was 33. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, very, it's the most advanced of all the type, worst of the worst, if you will. So in the first 10 years of our efforts to do this, we reduced the adhesion score from 33 down to 18. We thought we were doing pretty good, but I wasn't satisfied. We implemented a whole new set of strategies in about 1994 until about 2004, so the next 10 years. And our adhesion scores went from 33 down to 6.
Wow.
And 6 is almost no adhesions. But since then, we've implemented some additional new strategies yet. And we've done our first, I think, 10 or 11 cases with these new strategies. And our adhesion score is from 33 down to about 1.
Unbelievable.
I mean, you absolutely, it's just totally amazing to me what we've been able to accomplish surgically. And so we're doing surgical procedures which most people wouldn't recommend or do because they think that you're going to get scar tissue from all of that. But they don't know how to do the surgery, and they haven't been down the same path we've been down, and I've been looking at this for a long time, and we implement all sorts of different strategies to accomplish this. It is now published to a certain point, at least down to the 6 number, in our textbook on the medical and surgical practice of naprotechnology, and there's lots of pictures in that book. It shows all the surgical procedures and so forth. But it allows us to take what are really legitimately surgical diseases and treat them surgically. A good example would be the condition endometriosis, which mm-hmm. for the most part is treated medically in today's world of reproductive medicine or obstetrics and gynecology, but it's really not a medical disease. It's a disease that has to be treated surgically. In other words, we have to remove the diseased tissue. Otherwise, it'll come back 100% of the time. It'll continue to cause problems, pain, whatever the situation is for the woman, infertility, whatever. But if we go in and remove it, then we get much better results in terms of fertility rates, and we also get better results in terms of chronic pain or acute pain, like severe menstrual cramps. So it's really exciting surgery. We're now in surgery 4 days a week at Creighton University Medical Center, mm-hmm. and the type of surgery we do is what I'd like to say a lot of fun, and probably for your listeners, they would wonder if I'm all there when I say this type of surgery is a lot of fun. But when you can do so much good for people, it really is a lot of fun, and I enjoy it every moment of it. We're able to do some things that really you have to, right now, you have to come to Omaha, Nebraska to get done.
I'm reminiscent of that scene from a Star Trek movie where Dr. McCoy goes into a circa 1990s hospital, sees someone laying there about to go into surgery, gives her a pill, and voila, she's healed. Is that the mindset of many doctors today, that somehow surgery is something that should be avoided at all costs, and if we can treat it with medication or something, that would be better form?
Well, sort of yes and sort of no. Actually, when I trained, which is quite a long time ago, and I was at the Mayo Clinic, there was that element where you try to avoid surgery if you could, because surgery still had its dangers. And I'm not saying that it doesn't have any danger today. It does. I mean, there are risks with surgery. There are also risks with medications. So it's maybe in the long run, it may balance out, particularly when you get as good a results as you get from surgery.
Mm-hmm.
I think what it's more a factor of, actually, because we've improved anesthesia, we've improved our ability to manage the fluids and all the different things that are necessary to keep everybody healthy. And remember, I'm, for the most part, operating on young people, reproductive age women. In a way, that's the best group of people to be able to do surgery on, because they're young, they're healthy, and they withstand these types of procedures very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at the current group of obstetrician gynecologists who are coming out of their training programs, I think more it's a factor that they simply don't know how to do these. They have not been trained. I think it's more a situation where they've had inadequate training for this type of procedure. So, and this is a factor of a couple things. One is the companies who manufacture the drugs that are used particularly for endometriosis have done an extremely good job of marketing them.
Mm-hmm.
They sponsor all the postgraduate education programs for the residents. They make sure that there are free samples in, you know, the little locker that they have and wherever they're practicing. And they have one-on-one conversations with these young doctors, and so that's kind of what they get. But it's created this image, a little bit like the Star Trek character, that you can give a pill and it kind of all goes away. And so people think, oh, isn't this great, except that it doesn't all go away. The recurrence rate after those pills that you use for endometriosis or injections is 100%. It doesn't even begin to touch the endometriosis. So it may make the pain go away while they're taking the pills, but they can only take them for 6 months or the injections. After that, it's too risky to continue taking them because they lose bone mass and a lot of other things. They get hot flashes. It's a sort of a pseudo-menopause that they are put into. When it comes to these medications, they're kind of creating the attitude that this will cure the disease, like other things we use perhaps would cure the disease, but it doesn't. Many years ago when I was starting in all of this, I gave patients these medications, and I was just curious for myself. And so I asked them if they would undergo a second laparoscopy at 6 months after they were on the medication. And when I did that, the endometriosis they had after 6 months was identical to what they had when we first started them on the medication. So I was very unimpressed with it, and it just motivated me more.
We'll return to Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers in just a moment.
Rediscovering True Feminism.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Just over 90 years ago, feminists succeeded in giving American women the right to vote. However, when a new feminist movement arose in the 1960s, support for abortion became a defining characteristic of feminism. Thankfully, that is beginning to change. With so many pro-life women holding and running for political office, more people are discovering that one does not have to be pro-abortion to be a feminist. Like many of the original feminists in America, such as Susan B. Anthony, women are realizing they can support equality of opportunity and protect the life of the unborn.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List, inviting you to join us in our battle for life. For more, go online to sba-list.org.
A prayer to St. Gerard Majella for the respect of life. St. Gerard Majella, women the world over have adopted you as their patron in the joys and fears of childbearing. Today, we invoke your intercession for the unborn children in our world. Pray that all people will look upon human life as a gift from God, not as an unwanted burden to be destroyed. Assist the efforts of those enlisted in the crusade of promoting the dignity and value of all human life, particularly the unborn. This we ask through Christ our Lord. Amen.
This is the Pope Paul VI Institute Minute with Dr. Tom Hilgers.
Giving an armchair tour of the Pope Paul VI Institute, our National Hormone Laboratory at the National Center for Women's Health helps physicians and medical consultants across the country. We test a whole range of reproductive hormones. Most laboratories only monitor a woman's hormones by the general phase of the cycle, or in pregnancy by its trimester, or by the day of the cycle. An exciting aspect about our standardized hormone testing is that we have reference ranges for every 2 days of a woman's menstrual cycle and for every week during the course of pregnancy. This confirms a woman's Creighton model charting patterns and allows us to diagnose a woman's reproductive cycle and to monitor pregnancies accurately. The National Hormone Laboratory has high quality standards and is a participant in the College of American Pathologists Proficiency Program. The Pope Paul VI Institute is building a culture of life in women's health care. I'm Dr. Tom Hilgers.
For a complimentary gift and more information on the Pope Paul VI Institute, log on to www.popepaul6.com. Spirit Catholic Radio presents Faith Check. Here's Greg Ewell.
The celebrated English convert John Henry Cardinal Newman pointed out that the Catholic Church can be likened to a tiny acorn which grows into a tree. Though it looks entirely different, it remains in its essence the same thing. Likewise, a human being grows from a tiny child to an adolescent through adulthood to old age, and he remains the same person with the same DNA. So too, the Church grows and develops as the living body of Christ. Of course, the church of over 1 billion people today is not a mirror image of the relatively tiny church in the first century Mediterranean that we read about in the New Testament, nor should it be. The church's organization and outward forms are dynamic, not static, and must change to meet the needs of the age. Yet the church remains the same church, believing the same faith. The church's doctrine also grows and develops, never contradicting itself, but deepening with years of reflection and clarification. For instance, it was not until Christ's divinity was denied that the Nicene Council gave us the creed we profess each Sunday at Mass, which states precisely what we do and do not believe about our Lord. And so grows the Church until the consummation of time. This is Greg Ewell for Faith Check.
We now return to Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers.
The equipment, I would imagine, has evolved greatly over the last 20, 30 years. That must be a great aid in being able to do the surgical procedures without as much trauma to the surrounding tissue.
Yeah, no, you're right about that. And one of the major pieces of equipment that's been so helpful is the laser. Laser is a technology. It's a light form of radiation energy, which does one or two things. It either vaporizes the tissue or it's a cutting instrument. But in either case, the collateral damage that it does to the tissue surrounding it is minimal, very minimal. And so whenever you can do that, it's very helpful. If you use a cautery, a big cautery at least, a potent cautery, it'll leave a lot of collateral damage, which is one reason you get the scar tissue in cases like this.
But a cautery is burning.
Cautery is a burning instrument. It doesn't get rid of the endometriosis and 100%, while 98% in our studies, recurrence rate. It's 100% with Lupron and Danazol and those drugs that we were talking about. If you do a laparoscopy and you can laser, it's the more mild forms of endometriosis that you can do this way, you can vaporize the tissue and it's gone. And the recurrence rate after that is less than 20%. Now, that's still kind of high, but it's a lot better than 100%. Then if you have more extensive endometriosis and you have to do an incision and go into work, and then you excise each of these areas, the recurrence rate at the point where we remove the endometriosis is less than 7%. So it gets to the point where you can almost completely eradicate the disease because the recurrence rates are so low.
It can also affect so many other areas besides with endometriosis, isn't that correct? I mean, helping fallopian tubes, for example, where women might be struggling in that area.
Right. You can get endometriosis on the ovary, on the fallopian tube, on the uterus, the bladder, the bowel, the rectum, the appendix, all of those areas. Sometimes we have to do bowel resections. We get the general surgeons in to assist us with that. Another technique, though, that we have to know how to use is what's called microsurgery. Microsurgery is a type of surgery where you're using suture about the size of a piece of hair, and you're using it under a magnification. So you wear a magnifying set of lenses, make the image seem a lot larger than it is, and you can use these very, very small sutures, which when you're working on the fallopian tube particularly, you need to do. You can take out the endometriosis, but when you repair it, you better use really small sutures so they don't cause a lot of problems in the future. You also use suture material that itself doesn't cause scarring or adhesions. And there are types of material out there that you can do that with. So, and there are certain types of sutures which are notoriously bad at producing adhesions. And so you stay away from those kinds of suture materials.
You've spoken in previous segment about the importance of under polycystic ovarian disease, that using the surgical technique to help get the ovary down to a size where it can function and regulate properly.
Yeah, one of the procedures that we do, and we do quite a few of these, it's called an ovarian wedge resection, which is a wedge of tissue taken out of these real large ovaries, and we reduce them down to normal size. The ovarian wedge resection is done here and there throughout the country by different surgeons, but it still hasn't regained its popularity of 50 years ago, when it carried with it the very highest success rates with regard to pregnancy, especially in women who had polycystic ovaries. There were two reasons why it fell in sort of disrepute, if you will. One is that the procedure used the wrong suture material that I mentioned earlier, and it caused a lot of scar tissue. The second was that there was a drug called Clomid, which became available, and it was promoted big time. Have people think of it as an alternative to surgery, so surgery became sort of passe. The problem with all of that was it was probably one of the first times when the drug companies really promoted a treatment which wasn't quite as successful as we all thought it was. And with Clomid, what they would do is they would publish ovulation rates. If you had a woman who had polycystic ovaries and she didn't ovulate at all or very seldom, and you gave her Clomid and 90% of these women would ovulate, the presumption was that 90% would get pregnant. And for a number of years, it was very difficult to find actual pregnancy rates in women who took Clomid, but then they finally did appear, and in our own work we've been able to substantiate that the pregnancy rate with just Clomid alone is only about 30%. So, and even with the scar tissue, the wedge resection had a 70% pregnancy rate. Now without the scar tissue, we can get 80 or 90% success rates with pregnancy. So it's really a good procedure, and it's the closest thing that we have actually to a cure to polycystic ovarian disease. And it's surgical, and it's not a bad surgery. It's about an hour and a half surgery. We use the laser to make all of the incisions. We use suture material that doesn't cause scarring or adhesions. We use certain suturing techniques, which are designed not to do that as well. And then we use certain medications at the end of the surgery to also help that process. The hospital stays about 2 days, sometimes three, and the overall recuperation is about 4 weeks, although after 2 weeks they're driving again and getting around, they're just sore. So it's a great surgery and has a really low risk profile in terms of complications.
The post-operative period, I would imagine, is very important as well when dealing with any type of surgical treatment.
Yeah, with any of these surgical procedures, there's two things that are important. One is make sure you select your patient correctly for surgery. That's the beginning. And then after they've had the surgery, the ability to take care of them post-operatively. Now, most of the time, it's a smooth hospital course. The overall complication risk is really quite low. In fact, we did a study that we published in our textbook, which looked at major complications from a surgery where we made a big incision and did it, to another type of surgery called operative laparoscopy. Now, let me just diverge for a moment. Operative laparoscopy is a form of surgery which has kind of taken over gynecologic surgery in the last 10 or 15 years. And this is a type of surgery where everything is done through a laparoscope, regardless of how severe or not severe it is. The idea of this was initially that the women would get a lot less scar tissue, but it's been shown now that these procedures are really pretty significantly scar-forming procedures. So the difference in our patient population and the patients these other doctors use operative laparoscopy on, and we do a little bit of that, is that our patients want to retain their fertility and improve it. Many of the other situations, they may want that also, but they're not getting it, or they're being operated on just for pain, and then it's not so important if you get some scar tissue because unless it causes more pain, of course. So anyway, you've got this operative laparoscopy versus the bigger surgery where you have to make an incision. We compared the complication rates between the two, and you'd think that the surgery with the big incision would have more complications, serious complications than the operative laparoscopy. But actually, the complication rates are just about the same. And so there's nothing to necessarily say that operative laparoscopy is better. In fact, you can make a strong argument that it's not better in the cases we're selecting because they want to not only retain their fertility, but they want to improve their fertility. So the better you can do that with adhesion prevention, the better off you will be in the long run, and the patient, of course.
What attitude do you think would have to occur that an appreciation of these procedures would be more greatly accepted?
Well, I think what's going to probably have to happen is we're going to have to identify a few more of the major causes of infertility. We have identified a number of them so far. There's underlying hormonal abnormalities, there's mucus-producing abnormalities, there's ovulation-related abnormalities, and there's endometriosis. All four of those may occur in the same patient. But there's some other things that we don't know yet. This is important. We're going to have to find out. Once we learn more about that and we get 80 to 90% success rates with women with endometriosis and they get pregnant within 6 months after the surgery, that's going to be big, really big, because you get your disease treated, you reach your hope and goal and, you know, everything about becoming a parent. The actual surgery is not such a detriment. If I sit down with a patient, now you talk about the operative laparoscopy versus the major surgery, or the medication, and if I sit down and go through the complications of the medication, I go through the surgery and what it's going to take and its complications, and I go through operative laparoscopy, they will universally select the major surgery. Because if it's put up against a fair comparison, it's going to be the better of the three treatments.
It seems to me that this is yet another response to help couples choose in their desire to have children, to battle their infertility issues, that offers them a chance for the woman to heal, for them to be fertile, as opposed to, again, the battle is against in vitro fertilization and all of those mechanisms that really end up, you make Sophie's choices and you end up having to do things to your body that are not healing.
Yeah. Well, if you just were to kind of put it on a balance, the artificial reproductive technologies, which are in vitro fertilization and all of its sort of alphabet soup, if you will, and NAPRO technology, which gets to the root of the problem, treats the disease, and tries to construct an environment which is in favor of fertility. I mean, there's nothing really to compare in terms of the long-term future of the two. The artificial reproductive technologies will never find a cure to infertility, because unless they start looking at the underlying causes, which there's been no indication of interest in that, incidentally, they're not going to be able to cure infertility. But NAPRO technology has the hope, the real legitimate hope, of being able to cure this condition. And I really believe, honestly, that if put on an equal playing field, and just as an aside, we're one of the very few groups in the world doing this type of research over the last 30 years. So we've been doing this kind of by ourselves. I always say there's about one article in the medical literature every year that helps us.
Wow.
So out of thousands and thousands and thousands of articles, very few people are doing research that's much help in a natural environment. But we take this condition, we identify the diseases that we know of, and we help them get pregnant. If we identify all the diseases, which eventually we'll be able to do, or at least most of them, we're going to have 90% success rates. And when we get to that point, it'll be so obvious, so incredibly significant. I really, truly believe that we carry the potential to put the IVF clinics out of business.
The answers are there.
Yeah.
People are seeking. They just need to know to come to the Pope Paul VI Institute.
Well, we got more research to do. Well, I'll tell you what, there's still a lot to learn. But we do have very good results at the Pope Paul VI Institute. And on top of it, you get the diseases treated.
And without compromising faith, values, and
correct,
ultimately the health of both mother and child.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Dr. Thomas Soldiers. I look forward to next time.
Yep. Good to be here again.
You've been listening to Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. To hear and or to download this episode, along with many others, go to discerninghearts.com. To learn more about the work of Dr. Hilgers and the Pope Paul VI Institute, go to popepaulvi.com. This has been a production of discerninghearts.com, Spirit Catholic Radio, and the Pope Paul VI Institute. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join us next time for Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers.